This is Audible.
Power of TED, The Empowerment Dynamic, 10th Anniversary Edition. Written by David Emerald. Narrated by Ryan Sitzberger. Foreword by Lisa Leahy, Doctor of Education at Cambridge, Massachusetts, Harvard Graduate School of Education, Minds at Work. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Mary Oliver. I've shared Oliver's line with many people over the years. When I do, three observations emerge. 1. People agree on one point. Each of us has one life. 2. People tend to respond positively or negatively to the quotation. Few people respond neutrally. 3. Within those two reactions, there is significant variation in why people feel as they do. Some people are delighted by the question's reminder that their lives are in their own hands, while for others, it is a novel but wonderful idea that they could actually plan to do something with their lives. Other people feel ashamed of not being able to answer the question, and others are angry with the presumption that they can plan their lives. Still others laugh at the word precious, feeling quite clear that there is nothing precious about their lives at the moment. Instead, life feels like a weight, a fight, or worse. Some feel so beaten down that they say it seems foolhardy to even imagine being in charge of their own lives. You may have had another reaction. I've come to see people's responses to these 16 simple words as a window into two essential ways we see ourselves and our lives. Broadly speaking, one way is to see ourselves at the mercy of those around us, and the other is to see ourselves as having agency over our lives. We can move back and forth between these two mindsets, though people seem to operate predominantly from one or the other. As if it wasn't enough of a burden to experience oneself at the mercy of others, I've noticed that many people who feel this way are also suffering, feeling stuck, thinking badly of themselves, often quietly, though some people cover that up with their anger, and are almost always on their own, by themselves. They find it hard to ask for help for many different reasons, including not admitting to themselves that they need help and not wanting to appear weak by asking for help. Asking for help is hard. After all, we live in a culture in which the tacit message is that we ought to be able to handle such challenges ourselves. This notion is mistaken. As a developmental psychologist, I can tell you that our individual development needs to be nurtured, and that an ideal environment is one that both supports and challenges us. Too often we go without both of these conditions. If I could wave the proverbial magic wand on behalf of each of us becoming our best selves, I would make it so we could ask for help, and we could do so before things go terribly wrong, or before we feel overwhelmed and excessively stressed for being in over our heads. Without someone else's perspective, we tend to go around and around, repeating our default patterns and getting nowhere, except perhaps to feeling worse about ourselves for our lack of progress. Help is here, in this gem of a book. In this short, fast-paced, and wisdom-packed parable, Emerald takes us by the hand and lovingly shows us how our psychological default is to operate unconsciously from a state of fear and to take on different drama-based roles as a result. He helps us to see how living out of fear not only keeps us small, but creates a dynamic in which we keep others small as well. In other words, we limit our own potential as well as the people around us. We lose a connection to our vision and purpose. Emerald helps us understand the variation of people's responses I've described here, and how any of us can move from believing and reinforcing the belief that we have no agency in our lives to a belief that we are the only ones who are in charge of our lives. Because this is countercultural, I want to repeat that developing our capacity to take responsibility for our lives is an achievement that needs to be cultivated. If we did so, we would be able to use our one wild and precious life to create something meaningful. We would be available to support other people to do the same. And together, we might intentionally participate in our communities, in our home, our work, our neighborhoods, to do something bigger than any of us individually could. Dare I say that we could together create peace? If all this sounds lofty and impossible, let me say it this way. If we could develop our capacity to plan and live our lives fully, we would feel less like victims, helpless to solve the problems other people make for us. We would no longer feel so exhausted from fighting, feeling badly about ourselves for not fighting back or for believing that we are not good enough. We would have energy to create more of the life we want. So read this book, Let Emerald take you by the hand. Remind yourself that he has walked this very path, as have I. And go find the community, even if it is just one other person, to provide you with what you want, need, and deserve. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom, taking the world into my arms. Mary Oliver. New Preface for the 10th Anniversary Edition by David Emerald. This book changes lives. That message has been communicated countless times over the past decade through emails, during workshops, at speaking events, in online book reviews, and in casual encounters when people learn that I'm the author of TED. And countless times I've been left almost speechless. I will share the reason why in a minute. From all reports, TED has impacted marriages, improved relationships between parents and children, informed premarital counseling, and healed multi-generational family drama. It's been used in middle school and high school curricula, in college social work and psychology classes, in addiction treatment programs and groups, in diabetes education and other chronic health challenge situations, in community poverty outreach and training programs, and in church youth and book study groups. It's been beneficial for the community of Rwandan immigrants after their country's 1994 genocide and their work of reconciliation between Hutus and Tutsis. TED has been widely deployed in leadership academies, by leadership teams and organizations, and has become the cornerstone of company cultures. And these are only examples that have been brought to our attention. There are others we do not know of. Here's one illustration. A gentleman who looked to be in his early 40s stopped by our book table at a recent conference. "I've been looking forward to meeting and thanking you for writing this book. It saved my marriage." He proceeded to tell me a story of sitting in a hotel room in his hometown, estranged from his wife, holding a book a friend had given him, recommending he read it that night. He laid down on the bed, he said, and didn't get up until he was done reading The Power of TED. The next day he called his wife, apologized for his part in the drama of their marriage, and said he wanted to create a new relationship. I didn't know what to say or do, so I did and said what I have so many times. I stood, shook his hand, put my hand on my heart, and said, "Thank you. I'm so grateful that TED has touched your life." Beyond that, I'm nearly speechless in such encounters, because I often don't feel worthy of the praise simply because, like everyone else, on a daily basis, I, too, am seeking to live the principles and practices contained in this story of David and Ted and Sophia walking and talking along the shore where surf meets sand and where the human experience meets our spiritual essence. You see, the ways of thinking, relating, and taking action contained in this book changed my life as well, and continue to. For me, the old adage is true. We teach what we most need to learn. The story behind the story. The time has come to share a little of the genesis of what eventually became The Power of TED. At a critical time in my life, I faced all of the realities that the character David faces in the story. While working with a psychotherapist, a healthy choice when facing such challenges in life, I learned about the Cartman drama triangle and its roles of victim, persecutor, and rescuer. Then, one fateful morning, as I was sitting engaged in my morning quiet time ritual, a practice of some combination of inspirational readings, prayer, silence, and contemplation, a moment of surrender surfaced. And silently, I said to the God of my understanding, "I am ready to relinquish my victim stance in the world, but I need to know what is the opposite of victim." Immediately, the word creator came into my awareness. While I did not actually hear a voice, I can understand how some could say they do, My eyes flew open and I drew a deep breath. It was an utterly unexpected personal epiphany. That morning began the journey that eventually led to TED. Looking back, many seemingly miraculous meetings and events took place. Too many to detail here. I can attest to the famous observation made by W.H. Murray, the Scottish Himalayan Expedition, 1951. The moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision which no one could have dreamed would have come their way. Among them, for me, was learning of the work of Robert Fritz shortly after my morning epiphany and engaging in his Technologies for Creating. And then, not long after, meeting Bob Anderson, my dear friend and colleague, for now over a quarter century, who, through our shared passion for leadership development, introduced me to the mindsets and models of the orientations contained in the story, and over a dozen years ago, meeting Donna Sejan, my wife, business partner, and the mom of Ted, who first encouraged me to take that personal epiphany and begin to share it with others. Given my more than three decades of community and organizational communication, leadership, and organization development, it would have been easy to write a more traditional, non-fiction leadership book, and for those for whom such an approach might be more appealing, I suggest you start with the appendix, which contains a narrative outline of the concepts contained in the story. Instead, the spirit of Ted intervened. The call was to write a fable about self-leadership, for this is what I have come to learn, a lesson I am reminded of almost daily. The way we lead our own lives has everything to do with the quality of leadership we bring to our most important relationships, our families, our organizations, our communities, and now, more than ever, our world. As I write, our human family seems to be careening toward the ultimate choice point. Will we continue the downward spiral of fear, reactivity, and drama? Or stop, pause, and choose to upgrade our way of being in relationship with one another as creators, capable of honoring and respecting our essential unity with all its splendid diversity? It starts with me and you, and how we lead our own lives. My prayer is that TED touches and enriches your own life so that, in turn, you can help others. David Emerald. Chapter 1. A Fateful Meeting. From the bench where I sat overlooking the beach, it seemed I could see forever. The ocean spread out in a blue expanse, undulating its way into infinity. Yet, I couldn't really enjoy it. Inside, I was constricted. The surf, some 100 feet below the bluff on which my bench sat, normally would have sounded soothing. Its calm was lost on me as I struggled with an insistent emptiness inside. It had been a particularly painful period. The bloom was, indeed, off the rose. A couple of years ago, my wife and I had bought the perfect suburban starter home, nothing lacking but the white picket fence. We had envisioned it as a place to start our family. For so long, we had dreamed about having children. Then, months after the untimely death of my dad, with whom I had been very close, we received word from our doctor that I was infertile. Not only had I lost Dad, but now I felt that I was the victim of my biology. To my mind, the link between generations, first between me and my dad, and now between me and the child I had dreamed of fathering, was permanently shattered. After months of anguishing over options, my wife entered her grief and withdrew from our fragile marriage, unwilling to consider adoption or medical alternatives. Feeling abandoned and alone, I descended into despair as we separated and, eventually, divorced. I was bereft. Everywhere I looked, my life hurt. Tears filled my eyes, and the beauty of the beach before me became even more obscured. I had always assumed I would have a family when the time was right, and that the marriage vows of in good times and bad, would see us through any trials and tribulations. Not so. The time, it seemed, was never, and the vow proved to be conditional. I lived a good moral and ethical life. The question swirled and stumbled through my mind. What sort of karma is this? What seeds have I sown to reap this unjust penalty? Why me? The void felt as big as the sea before me. I took my pen from the clasp of my leather-bound journal and opened it to a new page. This repository of my thoughts and questions and yearnings had been a constant companion over the years. Journaling had become a way of processing my experiences, and I was grateful for the insights that often emerged. As I wrote, emotions washed over me, and my rational mind found its still, small voice. Instead of answering my questions, it simply whispered that this was the hand I had been dealt. Life was challenging me to find a way through what seemed to be a life of powerlessness and victimization. In this struggle between heart and head, inwardly, I cried out to spirit, "I'm sick and tired of feeling so small." And in that moment, I chose to surrender my stance as victim. But for the life of me, I didn't know what to replace it with. "What," I wrote, "is the opposite of victim?" If the crashing waves contained the answer, I didn't understand their language. In that moment, I closed the journal and returned the pen to the holder that served as a clasp. Closing my eyes, I breathed deeply, savoring the salt air. Again, I inquired, "What is the opposite of victim?" This time, the response was immediate. "Creator," the inner voice announced. "The opposite of victim is creator." I felt a chill course up my spine, and I took a deep, full breath of sea air. Suddenly, there emerged a feeling I had not had in a very long time. A fresh sense of hope began to make itself known. I sat for a few precious moments, drinking in the sounds of the surf and the release that accompanied the revelation of this new and different way of being in the world. I wondered, what does it mean to know that the opposite of victim is creator? What do I do now? I knew I had to stay open and receptive to whatever guidance might be forthcoming. A new friend. I don't know how many minutes I sat there, enveloped by the sounds and the sense of the sea, before I heard the faint sound of footsteps on the sandy path leading up to the bench. When I opened my eyes again, I saw that someone had silently joined me on my seaside bench. He sighed. "What a sight. It's hard not to be inspired from this vantage point, wouldn't you say?" All I could do was nod. I managed a slight smile. "Hi, I'm Ted," he said, extending his hand. "Mind if I sit here? I don't mean to intrude." I shook his firm, friendly, and strangely familiar hand. "David," I simply said. I had come to that bluff overlooking the sea to contemplate, to try to make some sense out of the unexpected twists and turns my life had taken. It seemed that a new choice was being offered me, though I was anything but clear about what it all meant. My emotions were caught in a cross-current between grief and hope. Despite the new direction I had been given from within, I felt disoriented. And now, here was this friendly stranger beside me. He had a walking stick, more like a staff, that he held with both hands between his knees. I couldn't tell if it was fashioned from the branch of a tree or if it had been a long piece of driftwood that may have washed up on the beach. In any case, it was worn smooth except for a few knots that appeared like dark eyes along the shaft. We sat there in silence for a long time. I didn't know it yet, but I had just met a teacher who would help me answer some of the most important questions in my life. It was the beginning of getting to know Ted. "So what brings you here to this bench and this magnificent moment?" he asked. A fair question, I thought. But who was this guy? Why should I tell a stranger what was going on with me? There was a quiet expectancy in his presence, as if he knew I had something to share. Yet there was a spaciousness that put no pressure on me to speak right away. I sensed that I could wait 5 seconds, 5 minutes, or 5 hours. Time was not of the essence. What was on my mind and heart was. There was a comfort, I felt. He seemed so friendly, and his question was certainly an open invitation. I ventured forth. Oh, I've come here to think, you know, just to sit and reflect. That's good to do from time to time. It's all too easy to run through life without reflecting. Life's lessons can be lost if you never pause. What a beautiful place to come and take stock. Yes, it is, I replied. Though I have to admit, I sometimes lose sight of all this beauty when I get caught up in my own drama. Oh, yes, drama, Ted remarked. That seems to be such a big part of the human experience. Look at all these people walking on the beach. Every one of them probably has some sort of drama going on in their lives. They all have their stories. What, if I may ask, is yours? I don't mean to intrude. I'm just curious. Then it all spilled out. I told him about everything. My recent divorce, the death of my dad. I even told him about my infertility. He nodded, encouraging me. I didn't detect even an ounce of judgment coming from Ted, or pity, for that matter. He looked out over the ocean, turning my way occasionally, and nodding in acknowledgement. Emboldened by his calm acceptance, I shared the full depth of my inner struggle, how I had felt like a victim. The whole mess just flowed out as Ted listened. For some reason, though, I wasn't quite ready yet to divulge the revelation that Creator was my new alternative. The stance I must take to replace the old sense of being a victim of my own life. Instead, I said, I've come to see how much of my life I have lived from the perspective of being a victim. I'm ready for something else. Ready for BFOs.
You're not alone, you know, said Ted. Victimhood is the malaise of humanity. It is everywhere, in every language. Most news reports are stories of victims and persecutors, and sometimes rescuers. People look for someone else to blame. Sometimes they demand compensation for their victimization. Sometimes they strike back. Terrorists attack and leave victims in their wake, all the while describing themselves as victims of oppression. On the roadways, some drivers feel so victimized by the chaos of traffic that they're filled with rage and lash out. People talk about being victims of abuse and neglect, victims of alcoholic or drug-addicted parents, even victims of birth order among siblings. At work, people talk about their victimization at the hands of an insensitive boss, a backstabbing coworker, or the company they work for. Some people feel constantly victimized by the elusive goblin they call the system. I let his words sink in. As I thought about how often I gave voice to my own sense of victimhood, I offered. It's amazing, isn't it? How often we use the blaming words of victimization. The traffic made me late. I got up on the wrong side of the bed. I ended up in the wrong lane at the grocery store. The examples are endless. There must be a better way. Ted turned and put his hand on my shoulder.
It's true. There is.
I asked him. But who are you anyway? What brings you to this spot overlooking the beach?
Ted wrapped his hands around his staff and looked at the scene before us.
I come here a lot, to take in the ocean and to do the kind of contemplation that just naturally arises in this beautiful place. Today, I saw you here, so I came over to sit and share a few thoughts.
Thoughts about what?
About the very subject you've introduced, about being a victim and the desire for a different way of being in the world. I've learned a few things that I think you may find useful, things that may surprise you.
Well, if you know something that I don't, I mean, about not being a victim, well, then I'm all ears, I said.
Good, said Ted. You need to know, however, that what I have to say could make you a little uncomfortable. That's because what I say will probably challenge the ways you engage with just about every area of your life. Your relationships, your work, the way you deal with disappointments, everything. Are you up for that?
I looked at the waves rising and rolling into the shore. Why had this spirited stranger suddenly shown up by my side? The encounter had a dreamlike quality. I wasn't sure what to say. I could have got up and walked away, but I didn't want to. Somehow, I felt entirely at ease with Ted.
and I was intrigued. Ted continued, "If this sounds interesting to you, and you want to hear more, then it's only fair to warn you. Be prepared to be visited by BFOs." I chuckled and turned to him. "I'm going to be visited by UFOs?" "No, BFOs. A BFO is a blinding flash of the obvious. It's something you already know, but which lies just beyond the edge of your conscious awareness. When they come, welcome them. A BFO is a very positive sign. It means that you're awakening to new ways of thinking and being."
"Oh, good. For a minute there, I thought you were about to tell me that you were from outer space." I laughed.
"If anything, I'm from inner space."
"Who are you, then?" I said.
"Just a friend, bringing you a lighthearted approach to a most serious subject. How you relate to your life experiences. You could say I'm a countercultural type. I live in the world in my own way. So many people meet their life experience from the victim orientation. Just as you've begun to notice for yourself, I have a different orientation. It's a simple way of being, though it's not always easy. I guess I'm also a revolutionary, or rather an evolutionary. As an evolutionary facilitator, I'd like to offer you another way to live, if you choose it. At the end of the day, what you do will always be your choice. No one can ever take that away from you. In fact, it's why you're here, to make the choices that create your life." It was a lot to take in. I searched his face. He didn't look like a fanatic. In fact, the gentleness in his eyes made me feel relaxed, in spite of all my recent turmoil. He added, "I won't mind if you'd rather not do this right now, you know. It's entirely up to you. In the end, it's all about choice." My choice. I sat another moment in silence as Ted waited patiently. Should I leave or stay and see where this weird conversation might go? I decided I had nothing to lose, and anyway, listening to Ted was already a lot more interesting than wallowing in the worries that had brought me up here in the first place. "Would you like to walk with me for a while, down on the beach?" asked Ted.
"Okay, sure." Ted and I got up together and started down the meandering path to the shore. Little did I know that I was setting out on the path to a whole new way of seeing.
Chapter 2. The Dreaded Drama Triangle. We walked down the slope of the bluff onto a path that wound its way to the sandy shore below.
"So David, tell me more about your thoughts on victimhood," Ted suggested.
"Well," I said, "it seems like victimhood is all-pervasive. I've been thinking about it since I learned about the drama triangle. Ever heard of it?"
"Tell me more."
"It comes from the work of Stephen Karpman, a psychotherapist who described the triangle in the late 1960s. It involves three roles, all of which I play pretty well."
"Yes," said Ted. "It's been around a while, all right. That model has helped countless people make sense of their situations. What strikes you about it?"
I told Ted what I had learned about the drama triangle. "The central role is victim. When I feel as if other people or situations are acting upon me, and I can't do anything about it. Sometimes it feels like being attacked, and sometimes it's just a hardship. I might feel mistreated or discounted, and maybe out of control. The second role is persecutor or perpetrator in situations of abuse. The persecutor is the perceived cause of the victim's woes. The third role is rescuer, the one who intervenes on behalf of the victim to deliver the victim from harm by the persecutor." Just then, Ted and I rounded a bend into a jagged maze of sandstone blocking the path to the beach. As I stepped out of the rocks and onto the sandy path, my foot gave way.
Whump!
I landed squarely on my rear. We laughed. Nothing was hurt but my pride, and Ted offered his hand.
"Here, let me help you up," he said, pulling me upright.
I spanked the sand off the seat of my pants, and we continued gingerly down the path.
"That was an interesting example of what you just described."
"How's that?" I asked.
"Did you feel like a victim when you fell back there?" Ted asked.
"I guess so, in a way."
"So, if you were the victim, who was the persecutor?"
"Well, you were in front of me, so I know you didn't push me," I chuckled. "So I'm not sure there was a persecutor."
"Every victim requires a persecutor," Ted explained. "But the persecutor isn't always necessarily a person. The persecutor could also be a condition or a circumstance. A persecuting condition might be a disease, such as cancer or a heart attack or an injury. A persecuting circumstance could be a natural disaster, like a hurricane or an earthquake or a house burning down. So, what was the persecutor in your situation just now? I thought for a moment. The loose sand, maybe, or my shoes, I observed.
Right, said Ted. Either of those could have been identified as persecutor, and I was the rescuer when I reached down to help you up. It's a simple example, and there was no real harm done in this situation, but you just saw all three parts of the drama triangle in action. Other people encounter much more intense versions of the drama triangle every day, he continued. Whether it is subtle or intense, the effort to observe and understand this pattern is the first step in breaking the cycle of victimhood.
We paused to survey the length of the shore. Seagulls called out as they glided along the surf line. The waves roared as a fine mist swept over us. I breathed deeply.
Let's walk a little closer to the water. I want to show you something.
Ted moved with ease. His gait was relaxed as he matched his pace to mine. As we walked, he glanced down at the shells and bits of driftwood marking the sand. Ted bent down, picked up a seashell, and began tracing a large triangle in the moist, hard-packed sand.
Victimhood, the death of a dream.
Here's the drama triangle you were talking about, said Ted. It's great that you know about these three roles. Let's look at the dynamics that take place between them. Here's the victim. He scratched the letter V in the sand. Victims may be defensive, submissive, over-accommodating to others, passive-aggressive in conflict, dependent on others for self-worth, overly sensitive, even manipulative. They're often angry, resentful, and envious, feeling unworthy or ashamed about their circumstances. Have you ever felt or acted this way?
I remembered the months before my wife and I had separated, how I had alternated between walking on eggshells and blaming her, often loudly, for the distance growing between us. I loathed my fearful pattern in romantic relationships, an unspoken agreement to be whoever my partner wanted, resentfully avoiding her abandonment.
These roles describe attitudes I usually associate with other people, I said, but I see how I've acted in some of the same ways myself.
Ted nodded. There's another characteristic at the very heart of victimhood. At the core of any victim, you'll find the psychic death of a dream. All victims have experienced a loss, a thwarted desire or aspiration, even if they're not aware of it. It might be a loss of freedom or health or a sense of safety. The loss might even be one of identity or of a reality, such as when a belief, my spouse is faithful, is shattered, my spouse has had an affair. Well, that was certainly true for me. My dream of a family had died when I learned of my infertility. My belief in a wife staying by my side no matter what wilted with my divorce. And my identity as a son seemed to have died right along with Dad.
Ted continued.
The victim feels out of control, believing life can't change for the better. Taking that position, one feels powerless, helpless, hopeless, and at the mercy of unseen forces. The victim reacts with depression or shame. You feel sorry for yourself.
I can't tell you how many times I've privately thought, poor me.
Ted smiled calmly and gazed out at the surf.
Poor me is the victim's identity. That way of seeing yourself and your life experience determines how you relate to the world around you. Your orientation defines your reality. There's actually a lot of ego involved in maintaining victimhood.
Wait a minute, I said. Are you saying being a victim is just a matter of seeing myself that way? What about a battered child or someone enslaved against their will? Are you implying they created their own victimization?
Not at all, Ted responded. The experience of being the victim of violence is very real. There's no denying that people treat each other badly all over the world, every day. I'm saying one has a choice, however difficult or painful, about how to relate to those experiences. If you identify yourself as a victim, your choices are limited. there's another way to see things which allows you to meet even the most difficult circumstances. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Before you see things another way, you must understand how victimhood works. A while ago, I met a young woman who told me her story. Her name was Sophia, and her marriage was a mess. Her husband, Dan, had confessed to having an affair. Sophia had tried everything to avoid this downward spiral, even canceling her dance class, thinking Dan might be happier if she spent more time at home. Things improved for a while, but soon Dan began working late several times a week. One night, Sophia exploded. "I gave up my class to be with you, and you're hardly ever home." Dan argued, "Even when I am home, you're doing work or bring work, or your nose is buried in a book. I can't get your attention." The two decided to set aside Thursday as dinner out together night. After several months of special evenings, Dan and Sophia found less and less to talk about. Then one night, right there in the restaurant, Dan admitted his infidelity. Caught in public, Sophia felt she couldn't react. When I met her, she was trying to figure out how to win back Dan's heart from a faceless foe. She feared losing him and facing life alone. Ted continued, "The feelings that victims have, just as Sophia did, are all fear-based and produce various anxieties. These feelings, which often seesaw between passivity and aggression, drive behaviors. When human beings are afraid, they're programmed to react. This program, to fight, flee, or freeze, isn't all bad. It helps the species survive." "I can remember times when I've reacted in all three of those ways," I offered. "But toward the end of my marriage, I got defensive. I felt so guilty and ashamed about my infertility, and fought off those feelings by lashing out with biting comments. Or I just withdrew. A way of fleeing, I guess. I'm not sure what you mean about freezing, though." "Imagine you're trying to start a car that's buried under a snowdrift," Ted explained. "It doesn't budge. You freeze if you stop and take no action, either toward or away from the source of your fear. It's giving up and giving in to hopelessness. Frozen in fear, you avoid responsibility because you think your experience is beyond your control. This stance keeps you from making decisions, solving problems, or going after what you want in life. In the position of victim, you become hyper-vigilant, always anticipating the next bout of suffering. All you see in life are problems, and these problems, whether they are people or circumstances, become your persecutors, the perpetrators of your misery. The victim role isn't maintained in a vacuum. Some person or thing must wear the persecutor label." Ted walked around the triangle in the sand. I stood with my hands in my pockets and looked out to sea. It seemed there were as many faces of the victim in this world as there were waves in the ocean. Ted knelt down and scrawled P for persecutor by the next corner of the triangle. The persecutor. Ted continued, "As you said, the persecutor is the perceived cause of the victim's woes. Persecutors and victims are symbiotic. One can't exist without the other. According to the dictionary, persecute means to harass in a manner designed to injure, grieve, or afflict, or to annoy with persistent or urgent approaches, as attacks, pleas, or importunities. Often the persecutor is a person, but not always. As I said, when you slipped on the path, persecution can be a condition, like a health challenge or a circumstance, such as losing your home in a fire. But whether person, condition, or circumstance, the persecutor gets the blame for causing the victim's feelings of grief, despair, and hopelessness." I can see all three kinds of persecutors in my life. My wife seemed like my persecutor when she became distant. My infertility was a persecuting condition, and Dad's death was a persecuting circumstance. No wonder I feel like a victim. Ted responded, "The poor me identity is reinforced by the persecutor, who looks down on the victim with an attitude of, 'You poor so-and-so.' When the persecutor is a condition or a circumstance, of course there's no personalization. That doesn't mean you don't take it personally. You do. But conditions and circumstances don't have personalities, even if hurricanes do have names." Ted chuckled at himself, then cleared his throat and continued,
When the persecutor is an actual person, the one who adopts that role tries to dominate others through blame, criticism, and/or oppression. These people are often authoritarian and rigid in their views, exerting power over others in an effort to keep others from having power over them. Persecutors may act grandiose and self-righteous to mask their own insecurity. They can be manipulative and defensive, often launching preemptive attacks. For persecutors, all situations are win-lose. Their motto is, win at any cost. Persecutors sound really heavy-duty. They're fearless characters, aren't they? I said.
They may be heavy-handed in persecuting, but they're also subtle sometimes. I don't want to offend you, David, but if you think you've never been a persecutor, think again. Remember what you said about vacillating between being passive and angry, blaming your former wife?
Sure, I remember. I felt uncomfortable as I sensed where Ted might be going.
How do you think she saw you when you lashed out at her?
He asked. Well, probably like, a persecutor.
Exactly. Victims often react to situations in ways that make them persecutors in the eyes of others. That's important in the drama triangle. Persecutors, like victims, act out of fear. They may seem fearless, but actually, persecutors are almost always former victims. They're mobilized by the fear of becoming a victim, nursing angry resentments about times when they felt victimized. Persecutors inwardly declare, "I'll never be a victim again." Ultimately, what they fear most is loss of control.
I laughed. Reminds me of Scarlett O'Hara in the movie Gone with the Wind. She proclaims, "I will never go hungry again," after she's lost her social position and all her possessions. She feels like a victim, but she ends up being Rhett Butler's persecutor. Ted smiled.
It sounds like a good example. Although I must admit that movies aside, there's enough drama for me in the everyday lives of the people I meet. A couple of weeks after I met Sophia, she brought her partner, Dan, to meet me. Dan felt bad that his affair had caused Sophia such pain, but he added it wasn't as if he had been planning it. He felt that in many ways Sophia was responsible. Dan wanted to be with someone who wanted to talk and laugh with him at the end of a hard day. He was pleasantly surprised when Sophia quit her dance class to spend time with him, until she began bringing work home with her and reading novels. After several months, Dan decided he was not going to allow Sophia's aloofness to keep him from having a good time. At first, he stayed longer at work, but that hardly felt like fun. He began going out with his single work friends who liked to play pool and darts at the local pub. At least now, Dan was getting to laugh a little. How can he know that Jessica, the sister of a friend, would take such a liking to him? He found their long talks, which had evolved into long, intimate walks, exciting and engaging. Dan decided he needed to tell Sophia what was happening, even if it meant an uncertain future. But Dan knew he couldn't settle for a marriage without intimacy and fun. Dan said, "If Sophia had been more attentive, we probably wouldn't have ended up in this mess." So, observed Ted, both Dan and Sophia felt like victims, while at the same time, each looked like a persecutor to the other. The dance of victim and persecutor might seem to describe the whole drama dynamic, but it's never a duo. It's a trio. A triangle of disempowerment. Chapter 3. A Drawing in the Sand. As Ted walked around to the third point of the triangle, I was lost in my own reflections. How often had I fallen into the role of persecutor? There were times I had insisted someone else was in the wrong. I just knew I had to be right. I had often blamed others for the way I felt or for the way things turned out. I didn't like seeing myself as a shadowy persecutor. It felt better thinking of myself as the innocent victim. Ted reached out with the shell toward the upper left corner of the triangle and wrote an R. The Rescuer. This third role, the one who steps into the dance between persecutor and victim, is rescuer. The dictionary defines the verb rescue this way: to free from confinement, danger, or evil, to save or deliver. The rescuer may also try to alleviate or lessen the victim's fear and other negative feelings. Here, too, a rescuer isn't always a person. Addictions to alcohol or drugs, sexual addiction, workaholism, all the ways we numb out, can rescue the victim from feeling his or her feelings.
I know how badly I want to escape from those feelings when I'm in despair, I admitted. Having one too many bottles of beer, playing just one more computer game, or zoning out with the sports channel might be rescuers I've used to feel better.
But it sounds like you're making the rescuer out to be a bad guy, I added. Isn't the rescuer supposed to be a hero, or at least a helper to the victim?
It might seem that way on the surface, Ted responded. A person who steps into the role of rescuer usually does so with a sincere intention to help. But think about it. What the rescuer is doing, often unconsciously, reinforces the victim's poor me perspective by saying or thinking, poor you. Same message, different point of view.
Ted pointed to the rolls with his walking stick as he spoke.
So you see, instead of helping or supporting the victim, the rescuer just increases the victim's sense of powerlessness. Unwittingly, the rescuer enables the victim to stay small, even though this may be the farthest thing from his stated intention. The victim ends up feeling ashamed and guilty for needing to be rescued and becomes dependent on the rescuer for a sense of safety. Rescuers look like good guys,